Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
It's a joy to be with Dr. Christopher Bellito, who's someone I've known for years and who's been very helpful for me as a greenhorn editor of a book, because Dr. Bellito is the general editor of a very beautiful series called Braille Companions to the Christian Tradition, and he has been doing that for 13 years, along with being a professor of history at King University in New Jersey. And because he has so much time on his hand, he wrote also a book. He just did a book, a beautiful book called Humility, The Secret History of a Lost Virtue. And I thought, reading the book, and when I first saw the title, I thought, what a timely book. What a necessary book in the current context. And I'm going to pass the microphone to him, so to speak, and ask him why he chose to write this book and how he approached it and what he wanted to achieve with this book.
Well, please. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and to be working together in a different way, in a different key than we were as author and editor. This book was not deliberately written in reaction to current events. Timing works out. But I, like many people, they discover the next book while they're writing the previous book. And so my previous book to this one was published in 2016, and it was called Ageless Wisdom, where I read through the Bible and tried to get a sense of the interplay of age and wisdom. This was published by Paulist Press. And I had never read the Bible from the first word to the last word straight through. As I was reading that, I, along with wisdom, humility kept coming up. And for a while, I thought that I would put those two things together, but there was just so much to do with humility that it was almost detracting from the points I wanted to make about age and wisdom. So I did what I often do, which is get a box or a file folder that says next project, and just started dumping the material in. And so when this book came out in 2016, the next project was to get some release time from my own university, for which I'm grateful, to start kind of drilling down. So I knew that my topics was going to be humility. Being an historian, I tend to start, at the beginning and move forward. So I did take a chronological approach rather than a thematic approach. All through the project, the working subtitle was a biography of a lost virtue. So in my mind, that's how I was kind of thinking about it. And then the editor at Georgetown University Press, Al Bertrand, who really helped, take this book from where it was. And I think he elevated it to the degree that it is elevated. That's Al's hand. And Al said that he thought secret history was a better way of looking at it. And of course, that gives a certain intriguing notion. And so I deferred to him as a publisher. But the fact that it was a biography meant that I was moving chronologically. So that was the second decision. The first, the topic. The second, the structure. And then the third was audience. So I wanted to do piles and piles and piles of academic research, but I also wanted to write a book that people would read. So like you and like our listeners, for whom I'm grateful, we have all read very, very good 200-page novels that were unfortunately 300 pages long, or an excellent two-hour movie that was 3.5 hours long. And so my goal was not to give you everything that I found. So at one point when I was shopping the book around, another press said to me, why didn't you write a 400-page book on humility? And I said, because I want people to read it. And I deliberately was writing for kind of a broader audience. So yes, there are footnotes, but I give two examples instead of 22. If I was writing an academic book, I would have given 22. So it comes out to about 180 pages, but I hope that that 180 pages is full, but not dense. And luckily, the National Endowment for the Humanities has a grant that I think is only a few years old called the Public Scholar Grant. And it is to support projects that are deliberately written for a broader audience to kind of raise. I don't like this notion that we're watering things down. I think what we're doing is raising the level of conversation. And so at the end, I was supported by this Public Scholar Grant, which married with the sabbatical, allowed me to spend about 8 months in the library at Princeton Theological Seminary, which is not far from my home. And since we had all been cooped up because of COVID for a number of years, when I rushed downstairs to tell my wife that I had won a sabbatical and this grant, she said, great, get out. And so I was very grateful that Princeton gave me a locked office and borrowing privileges, because, you know, as you're writing, you always have to look up that last thing and access to their databases. So there were a lot of people who kind of helped me with this book. So that's the kind of the genesis of the project.
Oh, thank you. So let's delve into the book and try to get a grasp of the argument. Maybe I should ask you about the general gist of the argument, right? Before we delve into so we'll start with the prologue and then we'll go through the different chapters. And as you said, the chapters are somewhat chronological. Yeah. Is there a general...
Yeah. So in part of the problem when you write a book, I mean, when I give book talks, I always, my opening line is that this is not a lab. This is not, you know, I'm so humble and you can be too. I was trained by Jesuits. They taught me a lot of things and humility wasn't necessarily one of them. So I'm not at all. That's the problem, right? So the epigram, which starts the book, is a Yiddish proverb that I got from a dialogue partner, a Jewish rabbi, with whom I've been giving presentations for years, who's a close friend. And it's the Yiddish proverb, too humble is half proud. It's delicious, right? Too humble is half proud. And so the minute you start talking about humility, every joke in the book can start to come up. So what's happened, I think, in the modern world is that the virtue of pride has been mistaken for the vice of the virtue of humility has been mistaken for the vice of hubris, thinking too much of yourself, or the vice of humiliation, thinking too little of yourself. And I think that humility, I mean, lots of people, when Augustine is asked for the three most important virtues, he responds, humility, humility, and humility. Dante says it is the first virtue. Hildegard of Bingen writes a play about the virtues in the 11th century, and none of the other virtues know what to do without humility. Humility is the captain of the team. And so there's a centrality to this particular virtue. And so what I found was that you've got these kind of twin competing strands in the ancient world. You've got a Judeo-Christian Islamic tradition. And then you've got a Greco-Roman tradition, but it's not like the monotheists are good and the polytheists are bad, because Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle really understand humility in a very positive way that we can get into, that say the Roman legions did not. And I should add that this is not a book that is written for or not for people of faith, because you don't have to be a person of faith to get the point of the story of Noah's Ark. Just as with Aesop's fables, you don't have to believe in talking animals to get the point that's being told by our parents when they told us, you know, these stories. So generally, in the ancient world, you have these competing strands. And the first is this begins with the Hebrew tradition, where think of Moses taking his shoes off in the presence of Yahweh. It's an acknowledgement, not so much of Moses' littleness, as much of Yahweh's bigness. And Yahweh's bigness doesn't make Moses worthless. He just understands that there are things that are bigger than he is. And so that's represented by the scene, right, where he sees, you know, the burning bush, and he says, you know, oh, I have to make some physical action to let Yahweh know that I'm recognizing that. And that is typically translated as the fear of God, which is a lousy translation, right? It's really awe in the face of something or someone greater. It's a disposition of reverence and obedience, which of course is absolutely central to Islam, right? The notion of submission and reverence and obedience. And so, you know, Moses, the lesson of Moses, I think, you know, which we get eventually in the book of Sirach, is that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and that self-understanding doesn't mean self-deprecation. And a good example of this is not so much Yom Kippur, but Erev Yom Kippur. So Erev Yom Kippur, Erev, the night before, the vigil of, the eve of. In the Jewish tradition, before you ask God for forgiveness on Yom Kippur, you ask those that you have harmed for forgiveness. It's a recognition that in humility, you go and say, I made an error and I'm asking for your forgiveness. Now, that might be a negative example. Let me give you a positive example. So there's this terrific story about a Talmud dispute that takes place when the Babylonian Talmud is being compiled. So this is around the first century BCE, and there are two schools or groups of scholars, one led by Hillel and the other by Shammai, and they're arguing about a particular legal point. And they go on for 3 years. And then finally, Yahweh, via a voice from heaven, comes down and he says, Hillel gets it right. So of course they ask Yahweh, why? And the response, and I'm quoting here from the Talmud, is because Hillel's scholars were kindly and modest. They studied their own rulings and those of Beth Shammai, and were even so humble as to mention the actions of Beth Shammai before theirs. So it's not, you know, we think our position is correct, but that doesn't mean that we can't learn from the other position, and the other position isn't entirely incorrect. So I think that that's a positive intellectual example. But of course, we could get this in any dispute that's occurring in our families or in our workplaces. So that's kind of the positive ancient strand. And the negative ancient strand is this word that the ancient Greeks use called hubris. And they use that for excessive pride, arrogance, narcissism. Of course, the famous story of Narcissus, the man who was so in love with his own image that according to different versions, you know, he falls into a pool of water and drowns, because he's looking at, you know, his own, you know, beauty. And to continue with a negative example, look at the Roman legion ritual of putting the defeated under the yoke, right? So you've got three spears, essentially. The, you know, two is kind of the door jams and one is the lintel. It's kind of an ancient version of the limbo. And you, as the defeated army, must walk under this yoke as an act of humility. I mean, remember that the Roman army doesn't just beat you. You know, I mean, they put their foot on your neck and they, you know, stab you right in the heart while you're watching. And that's demeaning, right? To be a slave in the ancient world, manual labor is demeaning. So if I can just continue there, it's very important to say at this point that this was not true of all Greeks, right? So Socrates is really, I open the book with Socrates and the famous story of the Delphic Oracle and his friend Chaerephon asking the Delphic Oracle, who's the smartest man in the world, who's the wisest man in the world? Socrates, the next logical question. Why? Because he knows that he knows nothing, right? Know thyself is the slogan over the Delphic Oracle. And mm-hmm. so, you know, this really freaks Socrates out. I mean, I'm quoting here from Plato's Apology. So what Socrates does is he goes around to all of these other people. He goes to politicians, he goes to artisans, he goes to poets, you know, and he discovers that each of those people knows what they do, carpenters, poets, whatever, but they don't know more than that, but they think they know more than that. Mm-hmm. So Socrates says, so I withdrew and thought to myself, I am wiser than this man. Mm-hmm. It's likely that neither of us knows anything worthwhile, but he thinks he knows something when he does not. Whereas when I don't know, neither do I think I know. So I'm likely to be wiser than he to this small extent that I do not think I know what I do not know. Right? I mean, it's really, so that, you know, that blows against the ancient, you know, Greco-Roman idea that the state of humility is humiliation, right? You are a slave, you are a prisoner, you're a POW, you don't have any dignity, you are less than, right? Lowliness is an absolute negative. And Aristotle, Socrates' intellectual grandson, of course, I think people think that virtue is the opposite of vice. And of course, the way Aristotle laid this out is that virtue is between two means. Mm-hmm. So to give a different example, so bravery is between cowardice and recklessness. And so for Aristotle, when Aristotle talks about pride, he's actually talking about humility, because he's talking about proper pride, the virtuous mean, the virtuous balance. We can kind of hear Confucius here, right? The doctrine of the mean. Mm-hmm. For Aristotle, proper pride is the virtuous mean or balance between the vices of thinking too much of yourself, vanity, hubris, and thinking too little of yourself, humiliation.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you for clarifying these two trajectories. And as I was listening, I mean, one question that arose is, there's still clear, there are clearly similarities, but there are also differences between these two traditions, right?
Oh, absolutely.
And because in many ways, the theistic or the Christian tradition, when you also talk about Islam and Judaism, seems to be a little more radical in many ways, right? It's not, as I read it, they don't talk about humility as a balance, right? It seems to me more radical, more emphasis on self-denial. Nevertheless, where the balance might arise is because you give several examples, Hildegard of Bingen is one of them, is that humility has to be understood in harmony with the other virtues, right? So it's in a way similar to the Greek or Roman view, or that virtue is a multiplicity, entails other virtues, as it's not just one, right? And you cite a very beautiful, just at the beginning of the book, page 2, humility is not humiliation. Humility is a virtue, not a vice. Isaac the Syrian, a wise 7th century person, described humility as itself humble. And what salt is to food, humility is to the virtues. But without humility, all our works are in vain. Humility, like salt, brings out the best in others. Without humility, there are no other virtues. And then you go into the story of Oderisi da Gubbio, right? The example of pride in Dante's Inferno.
What happens to in the Paradiso, in Purgatorio, excuse me, Dante lands on the terrace, the level called the patio called pride. And he meets there an artisan who, whose field was illuminating manuscripts. And his name was Odorizzi di Gubbio, as you mentioned. And, you know, of course, Dante's walking around basically saying, what are you in for? You know, as if they're in prison. And Odorizzi is weighed down by this arrogance. It's he strains under this big boulder. It's like Sisyphus, right? The myth of Sisyphus. And this boulder bends him double. So Dante's asks him, you know, what is this about? And so Odorizzi tells him the story that in life he was very disdainful of another artist by the name of Franco of Bologna, even though he knew Franco was a better artist. And so he tore Franco down unfairly in order to raise himself up. And so Odorizzi's pride had blinded his humility on earth, and now he pays the price. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, in the Middle Ages, they're just, you know, fascinated with this notion of virtue. One thing that I think maybe best it's better to talk about at the end is the notion of moderation, right? So we live in this very divided world, right? I mean, it's a 50-50 world. It's not just in the United States where I live. You know, there's far right and far left in lots of countries. And I think in the middle of all of those battles that we see in Africa and Asia and civil war, there's probably this 80% of people who are sane. But like being a radical is now being a moderate is now a radical position. Like, I don't know how that happened, but it's, you know, moderation is one of the things, you know, when Hildegard calls humility the queen of the virtues, right? And delightfully, she does not say king, but she says queen, which is why we love Hildegard so much. It's the key to everything, because, you know, a moderate approach is countercultural. I mean, this is what Jesus does, right? So Jesus, living in this, you know, coming from this Hebrew tradition, but living in the bad Greco-Roman examples, right? But knowing the good, the difference between virtue and vice, you know, here comes Jesus who blows this whole thing up. So that, I mean, you can imagine the Romans freaking out. I mean, just the very notion, right? So whether or not our listeners are Christian, you know, the theology is that God humbles himself by taking on human form. But here's the really important part: that human form is further ennobled. And so when Jesus says, blessed are the meek, he's not talking about the wimps, but those who are lower on a social scale through by dint of being born that way, or losing in a battle and being a POW, being taken as a slave. And, you know, these are the people that the Romans just trashed. And manual labor, which of course was the work of slaves, you know, Jesus is saying that there's a dignity to humility, a dignity to manual labor. So when he says things like the first shall be last and the last shall be first and the leader should serve, and here he's washing the feet of his disciples, and those who exalt themselves shall be humbled and those who humble themselves shall be exalted. You know, the Romans don't know what to do with this, right? They just like, they don't get it. And so you can see where this Jewish, Christian, and now Muslim concept of humility all kind of fold together, right? So I repeatedly ask Muslim scholars, I am not a scholar of Islam, I am not Muslim. And I repeatedly said, what's the word for humble? And every single one of them said, we don't have one. It's related to, and a word that kept coming up, apart from the fundamental submission and stance toward Allah, is patience. Patience is part of it. It's patience is tied to a positive or a healthy sense of meekness. So if I can give you an example from a Hadith collection, charity does not increase wealth. No one forgives except that Allah increases his honor, and no one humbles himself for the sake of Allah except that Allah raises his status. And there's a clear correlation there between that Muslim notion and the Christian notion of anyone who exalts himself shall be humbled and those who humble themselves shall be exalted. I mean, there's a clear line there, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're coming out of the ancient world, and if we can put Islam into the late antique world or the early medieval mm-hmm. world, you've got these two strands that are kind of competing with each other, mm-hmm. and they go clanging into the Middle Ages.
Mm-hmm. You mean the still the Greco-Roman more and then the theistic, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Except remembering that we have to realize that Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle are more in line with that more positive theistic version.
Yeah, because the theistic version and it seems to me more radical and almost like a singularity, right? Humility is mm-hmm. once you step out of it. I mean, you're already in danger territory, right? You cite the very page 127. You cite the famous passage from C.S. Lewis's Screwtape Letters, right?
And yes, right.
Can you read that?
Right. So for those who don't, don't recall, so it's 1942 when C.S. Lewis is writing the Screwtape Letters, which, as many of his books, began as radio addresses. Mm-hmm. And of course, 1942 is not a high point of humility in world history. Mm-hmm. And the story is that Screwtape is an undersecretary in hell. It's just such a delicious premise. And he's writing to his nephew, and his nephew is named Wormwood, great name. And Wormwood has been assigned his first soul, and the soul is referred to as the patient. Mm-hmm. And the goal is to make sure that the patient embraces vice, not virtue, because if the patient embraces virtue, then the Wormwood and Screwtape side, the devil side, will lose to the enemy. And it's always in the text capitalized. So the enemy is God. And so what he's doing here is he's playing with this notion, look at how humble I am, right? Mm-hmm. So this is Screwtape advising Wormwood on how to corrupt the soul of this patient. Mm-hmm. Your patient has become humble. Have you drawn his attention to this fact? Catch him at the moment when he is really poor in spirit and smuggle into his mind the gratifying reflection, by Jove, I'm being humble. And almost immediately, pride at his own humility will appear. If he awakes to the danger and tries to smother this new form of pride, make him proud of his attempt. And so I think what, it really captures the different levels of irony that's going on here. And it seems to be, if you read the other paragraphs in this letter, that Wormwood's patient is really kind of enjoying humility because he had been very self-absorbed, and now he's helping others, and that's bringing him much greater joy. So this is terrible in the eyes of Screwtape. This is an alarm bell. And so Screwtape continues, you must therefore conceal from the patient the true end of humility. Let him think of it not as self-forgetfulness, but as a certain kind of opinion, namely a low opinion of his own talents and character. Some talents, I gather, he really has. Mm-hmm. Fix it in his mind, the idea that humility consists in trying to believe those talents to be less valuable than he believes them to be. So he's saying, pull him to the two strands, the two wings of the Aristotelian notion. Either pull him to hubris or pull him to humiliation, but don't let him settle in that nice balanced middle of the true good pride or the true act of humility.
One of the most fascinating chapters of the book is chapter four, right? Chapter one is, just to summarize it, chapter one is ancient notions in humility. Chapter two is humility in a biblical key. Chapter 3 is a medieval golden age, and I think we've got a little bit of a few insights and facets from each of the chapters. The chapter 4 is a paradox of learned ignorance, and the title might be a little cryptic for people who are not familiar with that tradition in the Middle Ages. So I'm going to ask Chris to unpack that a little bit and explain what the tradition of learned ignorance is all about. After that, please go ahead.
Well, for me, I mean, I'm a medievalist, right? So of course, the most important chapters are going to be those two chapters, right? Which I think are the heart of the book. Chapters 3 and 4, a medieval golden age and the paradoxes of learned ignorance, because it's in my wheelhouse. Okay. But also I think, and again, you know, this is an age of faith as it's sometimes been called, but, the period of the Middle Ages has a lot to offer, even if you are not a person of faith, today. And what the Middle Ages got right, and I'm going to use their language, but again, you don't have to be a person of faith, is the balance between faith and reason, fides et ratio, right? So let's take the example of Abelard, right? So this Abelard is this 12th century philosopher and teacher. People know kind of the salacious story about Abelard and Heloise, and Bernard of Clairvaux, the founder of the Cistercian order in North America, known recognized typically as the Trappists, such as Thomas Merton. Bernard of Clairvaux kind of goes after Abelard, not because he's anti-intellectual, that's a caricature of Bernard of Clairvaux, but because Abelard has no guardrails. So what Abelard and others are doing, and again, they're benefiting greatly from Jewish and Islamic thought, is he says, we've got a lot of open questions and we've got a lot of contradictory rulings and teaching. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to write a book that's called Yes and No, Sic et Non. And I'm going to say, here's an argument, here's a discussion, and here are the arguments for it, and here are the arguments against it, and then I'm going to synthesize this, right? So this is even before Thomas Aquinas writes the Summa Theologica. He doesn't invent the scholastic method, but it's kind of bubbling along, and Abelard is the best example among several of this process of doing what? Of realizing that all of those rulings that say yes and no don't have all the answers, that there's good in both the yes and there's good in both the no. And where there are contradictions, let's try to steer the middle course. So we praise Abelard because he's an example of doing just that, right? Trying to take the emotion out of things and trying to find the steady course. But there is an arrogance to that too. And the arrogance, the temptation, is that we can figure it all out. And it's that we can take this as far as we can, and then we can't take it any further. That's Bernard of Clairvaux's position, and he's afraid that Abelard is going to kind of go too fast, right? So, I mean, to be gloriously anachronistic here, it's kind of like, I think it's a great idea that we can use stem cells to grow a new kidney for someone, because then maybe someone can live a longer life. But do I want people to start deciding whether they want their kids to have brown eyes or blue eyes, and somebody doing that in a test tube? That freaks me out and makes me nervous, right? So where is the line in all of this? And the kind of answer is this thing called learned ignorance, right? Which is very big in the Jewish, Muslim, and Christian tradition. And that is that I recognize my limits. And so you have a lot of reformers, educational reformers, who say, let's be careful here, okay? So let's use some of the words that they use. Like there's this thing called, I tell my students, there's a difference among information, knowledge, and wisdom, right? Information is anything I get off the internet, and they just presume it has to be correct because it's on the internet, right? Knowledge is when you take all of that stuff off the internet and start talking about what makes sense and what is logical and what can be verified by facts. Wisdom is entirely different from that. One need not be educated to be wise, right? You've got these, you know, we all have the example of a great grandfather or a nona in my own tradition who may not be educated at all, but is the wisest person. You would never make a life decision without talking to that person. And so in the Middle Ages, what they're saying is, yes, we can get scientia, we can get information, and maybe we can get knowledge, but that we have to recognize that that doesn't make us wise. This is what Socrates found out, or the people that Socrates questioned found out about themselves, which is why he was so annoying. And so you have someone like Jean Gerson, who's the chancellor of the University of Paris. So he would kind of be the equivalent of a provost in, you know, roughly in an American university setting. And, you know, he does this educational reform and he says, let's be very careful about curiositas for its own sake, right? So the cliche, curiosity killed a cat, right? So why are we studying? We're studying to understand things so that we can be better people, so that we can serve others, not so we can strut around and say that we know it all, not that we can, like Odorisi, champion ourselves by trashing others, Franco of Bologna in Dante's story. And so Gerson has this really delicious line where he says, discretion is the daughter of humility, right? Discretion is the daughter of humility. So now we begin to see what Hildegard was talking about when she says that none of the other virtues know what to do without the mother, without the queen of humility. And it's a very medieval concept, yes, but it's grounded in that Socratic idea that he is wise because he knows nothing, right? So if we're talking now about humility as self-effacement in the service and learning of others, well, if I'm going to be a medical doctor, I have to be self-assured and educated and know what I can heal and know what I can't heal. Know what I can heal and know what I can't heal. And so to use another example, someone that I study, Nicholas of Cusa, also known as Cusanus, who lived in the 1400s, the example that he uses, and as a philosopher, Adrian, you'll of course love this, right? Is that all of knowledge, God's knowledge, is a circle. And our knowledge is a polygon inside that circle. And no matter how close we mathematically get that polygon to be a circle, it will never be a circle. And at that point, you don't say, I'm stupid. What you say is, this is as far as I can take it right now. And I hand it off to the next generation. And then the next generation, I mean, to use a silly example, it's kind of like having a DNA sample from 1951, but not having a blood sample from 1951, but not the technique of a DNA analysis that you have in 1991 to solve the crime, right? So so learned ignorance to me is, it's something that I try to teach my, I try to remind myself to live my life like this, but I try to help students understand this as well. And what's really interesting for me, as we're moving into a world now, you know, 15th, 16th century, we have the kind of this creeping constitutionalism. Of course, that's part of the recovery of the Greek polis, is this notion that my knowledge and my skills are related to a common good. That if I am good at something and bad at nine other things, that I need to get nine other people who are good at those other things, and together we can form a community, right? And you know, there's this cliche that the Middle Ages was all about the community and the modern world is all about individualism. We can knock both of those cliches down, but there is a sense of the common good that you get in the Middle Ages that begins to get trumped a bit in the medieval, in the early modern and modern world, with this rise of individualism, which is not a bad thing, right? You know, like let's try to figure all this out. But if it doesn't have limits, I'm thinking of Blaise Pascal, right? So Pascal, who is a mathematician and a philosopher, but he also has this very intense experience of God, right? And he writes this note that he sews into his coat to remind him of it. And the note reads, fire, God of Abraham, God of Isaac, God of Jacob. Now he's putting that in religious terms. But, you know, it's this notion that no matter how much I know, I still have to get zapped when there's stuff that I don't know.
Yeah, and thank you. Now, this tradition then somehow is eroded and eventually more or less collapses, right, with the emergence of early modernity and mm-hmm. the emergence of early, you know, the scientific project. And you do a wonderful job in explaining the different nuances of that project. On the one hand, you have Hume, and maybe we'll cite that passage from Hume on page 111, who completely disparages and discards the Humility Project, along with Prince Albert as well. But then you have people like Bacon and Darwin, who still preserve a little bit of and then Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, who are aware of the danger of hubris, of the and still preserve a little bit this concern not to become hubristic. So maybe let's cite that passage of
yeah, let's contrast those two, right? So if you were a casting director of a Hollywood movie and you said, I want an Enlightenment skeptic who thinks nothing is good comes from religion, they would say, you know, call David Hume, right? Mm-hmm. And the best / worst passage example of this, it comes from his treatise on human nature, where he says, and I'm quoting Hume, every valuable quality of the mind, whether of the imagination, judgment, memory, or disposition, wit, good sense, learning, courage, justice, integrity, all these are the causes of pride and their opposites of humility. Humility is shame, not satisfaction of our looks, skills, positions, and accomplishments. And then you have these cautionary tales. And the two examples I'll give you here are Christopher Marlowe's Tragical History of Dr. Faustus, modeled after a real person, and Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, right? So the story of Dr. Faustus is familiar to us, an alchemist who sells his soul to the devil. Of course, this story is replicated in many, many cultures. In the United States, we have the devil and Daniel Webster. And at the end of this Tragical History of Dr. Faustus, which kind of reminds me of Voldemort and Tom Riddle and Harry Potter, at the end of it, as Faustus is essentially descending into hell, we have this passage from Marlowe. So this is in the late 1500s. Cut is the branch, speaking of Faustus, cut is the branch that might have grown full straight, and burned is Apollo's laurel bough that sometime grew within this learned man. Faustus is gone. Regard his hellish fall, whose fiendful fortune may exhort the wise only to wonder at unlawful things, whose deepness doth entice such forward wits to practice more than heavenly power permits. So those there's your guardrails, right? There's your guardrails. And so Mary Shelley, and of course the great story of Mary Shelley outwriting her friends in this writing competition, you know, these are rich people who have villas, and they're in, I think it's near Lake Como, it's a dreary summer day, and she's dozing, taking an afternoon nap, and she has this image of this body being reanimated, and she, at the age of 19, writes Frankenstein. And so if I can contrast two passages from this, one is early, when Victor Frankenstein goes to university and is just taken by this notion that we can figure it all out. So Frankenstein, young in his career, says, no one can conceive the variety of feelings which bore me onwards like a hurricane in the first enthusiasm of success. Life and death appeared to me ideal bounds which I should first break through and pour a torrent of light into our dark world. A new species would bless me as its creator and source. Many happy and excellent natures would owe their being to me. No father could claim the gratitude of his child so completely as I should deserve theirs. And of course, we know the story that he loses control of the creature who causes a great deal of mayhem because he's rejected. And so at the end of the story, which mirrors the end of the story of Faustus, although instead of Faustus speaking, here Mary Shelley allows us to hear directly from Victor Frankenstein, his life and other the lives of others destroyed by this creature he couldn't control. Learn from me, if not by my precepts, at least by my example. How dangerous is the acquirement of knowledge, and how much happier that man is who believes his native town to be the world than he who aspires to become greater than his nature will allow. And of course, Percy Bysshe Shelley, her husband, writes the famous story of Ozymandias, right? I'm walking along a desert. I see two like calves, right? The bottom half of somebody's legs. Obviously, this was a gigantic statue, and there's an inscription that reads, "My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, in despair." And then Percy Bysshe Shelley tells us, "Well, nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away." So we have these kind of cautionary tales.
Yeah, and in spite of these cautionary tales, and here we are, right? And I think the issue of AI might have arisen in with all its force after you finish the book, because now we're dealing with another Frankenstein type of temptation, right? With the entire AI issue, which is an entire conversation in itself. And I think this book, is a good reminder, if not a warning. But one vignette that you bring in the chapter five, "Modernity Forgets and Starts to Remember," nicely put, is Ben Franklin. And I think that his example is very important, especially for Americans, right? It's very beautiful, right? The way page 115, you recount how he adds as a goal for himself, imitate Jesus and Socrates, right? And then how he retrieves and rediscovers a tradition of learned ignorance. I forbid myself the use of every word or expression in the language that imported a fixed opinion, such as certainly, undoubtedly, and I adopted instead of them, I conceive, I apprehend, or I imagine a thing to be or so, or it so appears to me at present, right? Which Ben Franklin, who is not necessarily a trained philosopher, but a very much handyman, a scientist, but a very practical man, right? So in a way, shows how there is a need of a return to a certain common sense, or as an attempt to be more grounded, and that maybe that's a reminder and a warning again for academics and academia, who are very easily, go please.
Yeah, well, as a teacher, even before AI, I would always say to my students, why would you cheat when you can think? And I think particularly when you're dealing with younger college freshmen, sophomores, and I teach a working class population, one third of my students are first gen for college. I think that which reminds me of my own grandparents, all of whom came through Ellis Island, that some of them don't think they belong there. Some of them don't think that they have enough smarts. And so they might cheat because they think that what they can find is better than what they can come up with on their own. And so I have discussions with them is, why would you go to AI? Why would you take someone else's ideas? What that means is you don't have enough confidence in your own idea. So let's talk about why you don't have that confidence, right? And it's very easy to, when your students start putting whilst and the word honor has a U in it, it's very easy to catch this kind of thing. But it's also this notion that why are you presuming that the AI has a better insight than you do? I also want to build, this is why I talk about proper pride. I want to build confidence in my students. Humility doesn't mean I'm stupid. Humility means I know X amount and there's more to learn. And th- the more to learn comes in my classes in looking at primary sources that contradict each other and trying to figure out the Venn diagram of what's likely to have happened and an analysis. So I think what I'm trying to cultivate in my students, I think what I hope I'm trying to offer in this book is that humility is kind of a disposition. It's like a fundamental disposition, or you could use, I don't know, what other word you want to use, posture, stance, attitude, right? It's a healthy state of mind. It's a sense of perspective and proportion. Where do I fit in within this larger world? And once, I mean, this is, in some sense, this is kind of, you know, though I didn't write the book as a commentary on current events, in the epilogue, I did ask myself, well, we've done this history of humility, you know, what is the takeaway? So famous Jesuit church historian named John O'Malley, who passed away in 2022, he would always, at the end of his class meetings or even public lectures, say, so what? So we spent, you know, an hour and a half on the 16th century. So what? What's the takeaway? So, you know, so what? Well, you know, if I can offer this, I think the so what is that once you embrace humility as a virtue and not a vice, automatically it moves monologue to dialogue, because you have to listen to other people. Right. And if you have to listen to other people, it's grounded in self-awareness and self-reflection and fixing our flaws. That's why Erev Yom Kippur is a good example, which I didn't come up with. Was brought to me by this rabbi partner. And there's an awful lot of, I find, stubbornness in the world, this imposing my view on others. Not by because I'm making a better argument, but because I'm essentially being a bully, right? I'm bulldozing you by imposing my views on others. And what does that do? It doesn't convince anybody. It just engenders, you know, people. As I said, I feel like there's this big middle, this radical moderate position. And sometimes, you know, if you turn on two different radio stations or two different television stations, you know, a number of my students, and I'm wondering if they themselves come from families where they had feuding parents who may have divorced, say that listening to the radio and watching TV and watching the, at least the, speaking from the American political scene, is like watching two parents who hate each other argue all the time. So I don't see a lot of humility in our public discussions today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely this public aspect, along with, right, also the culture of competition, right, that a lot of our students are involved in, right, the rat race. You are there, you have mm-hmm. to prove yourself, you have to compete, and you have to promote yourself, right, mm-hmm. along with this, you know, and I think that's why the call for humility is very timely. And you emphasize that it's a practice. It's something you learn. It's not something theoretical, but it's something that you need to practice, right? It's not a one-time thing. But, you know, I'm not sure if I say I'm pessimistic, but and I think another good use for humility is this taking away pressure, right? Given the rat race, given the competitiveness, especially the pressure that first-time college students have, they have to perform, they have to prove themselves. It's a huge amount of pressure, and it's daunting. And a lot of these issues with anxiety that and mental health that we see are rise in college in higher education could be, I think, mitigated, or if not, by humility, by remembering or retrieving humility. But I'm not sure how, let's say, realistic that is. I'm a believer in humility myself, but the competition out there is so you know, violent sometimes, that, you know, they have a hard time embracing something that seems to undermine that competitiveness. I don't know.
Yeah, and also I think, I mean, as so I'm a husband and I'm a father, and I know I felt in the spring of 2020 when we were going into lockdown, this tremendous feeling of being powerless, and this, and maybe it's caught up in some sort of macho paternal culture. You know, I have to keep my family safe, and then I was faced with, I might not be able to keep my family safe. There may be forces that are larger around here, and so we've got to make some decisions as a family, you know. And COVID was a humbling experience, and I wonder if we blew that opportunity to learn. Because I mean, you know, however you feel about masks, whether they're right, whether they're wrong, whether they're good, or whether they're bad, as I look back, what we said was wear a mask to protect other people. And I think part of the reason that people weren't wearing masks were like, well, you can't tell me what to do. But if we told people wear a mask to protect yourself, everybody would have worn a mask, because our default, I mean, there's nothing wrong with protecting, you know, physically protecting yourself or protecting your family, of course, right? That's the responsible action. But beyond that, you know, very intimate and basic stance, what is our responsibility to the community, to the common good? And this is what, and I'm sure that political philosophers will tell me, and I'm not a political philosopher and I'm not an historian of the American experience, but just, you know, approaching 60, you know, there are ebbs and flows and trends. And it seems to me that there are times where in E pluribus unum, where we've been emphasizing the unum, and then there are others where we've been emphasizing the E pluribus. And of course, the problem is that we make it E, you know, we say many or one, when, you know, again, that the Middle Ages understood the balance. It's many and one. It's the individual and the common good. They're not in competition with each other. And I, my hope is that not only can we be more humble as individuals, but that we can be more humble as communities. But we can't be more humble as communities unless we're more humble as individuals.
Beautiful. Yeah, beautiful way to summarize it. Thank you. Thank you, Chris. What are
Thank
you
you.
what's the next project about?
What's next? I don't know, because this was the first time in my life where the idea for the next book didn't arise while I was working on this book. And I'm fine if this is my last book. I continue to write scholarly articles on 15th century church history and reform and things like that, with lots of footnotes, because a geek like me thinks that's fun. So I don't have another book project. And if I get another one, that's fine. And if I don't, that's fine. That's fine too.
Ending in a very humble way.
Well,
And I said
I
that, you didn't
suppose.
say it.
Okay. But I'm
Thank
very grateful that you devoted your the New Books Network chose this book, and I'm grateful to you for doing so particularly.
Yeah, thank you, Chris.